From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Coming up, we talk to Governor Gretchen Whitmer about this week's natural gas crisis. We also hear about Betsy DeVos's proposed changes to Title IX regarding campus sexual assault.
Biggest concern with the draft regulations is that they would ask colleges and universities to become courts.
Then an audit of the Michigan Strategic Fund, also ridiculed as corporate welfare.
We're rightly starting to investigate whether these things make sense or not.
We lost a leading architect of the mid-century modern movement.
She would call herself an interior architect, not an interior designer, and certainly not an interior decorator.
And an artisan of Michigan builds reproductions of the first pianos.
He got the idea of equipping these instruments with a much more precise and profound capacity of dynamic variation.
Welcome to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Well, this week got pretty interesting, right? The polar vortex plunges Michigan into below zero weather, and then Consumers Energy had a fire at one of its natural gas facilities. The call went out. Businesses were asked to shut down. People were asked to keep their thermostats at 65 or lower. We basically had a natural gas supply crisis on the coldest days of the year so far. Why? Well, that's something Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer says she wants to know. Welcome back to Stateside.
Thank you. I'm so glad to be with you.
You've ordered the Public Service Commission to look into this natural gas crisis. What do you want to know?
Well, I think the events of the last few days here, we had an unprecedented storm. The weather patterns are changing as a result of global warming. And I want to know that we as a state are prepared that when another event like this happens, because they're increasingly happening, that we've got we're able to fulfill the demand. We've got the resources and a plan and a contingency plan so that we're never in such a precarious position again.
Yeah, I was wondering about redundancy. I mean, what does this say about how fragile the natural gas infrastructure is across the state?
Well, you know, we were watching it very closely. We knew it was going to be a very cold week. I declared a state of emergency and got the State Emergency Operations Center up and running. And thank goodness we did, because when the magnitude of the issue became known, we were able to mobilize quickly and, alert the public. People voluntarily curtailed their use, and that meant the system did not fail, and that was a good thing. But that is not something that we want to have in practice. We've got to make sure we beefed up the infrastructure and that the infrastructure between utility companies is more robust as well. DTE was supplementing some of the consumers' gas. But had we had a better infrastructure between the two companies, it appears that that might have been a help as well. So I want the MPSC to analyze it, make recommendations, do a thorough process. And so we've got a real plan, and we start executing on that plan so Michigan residents are protected.
Do we have any idea or any theories about why this gas compressor caught on fire?
I've not heard that analysis. I'm sure that Consumers is going to be sharing that with us, but I don't know that they've had the opportunity to really have a thorough investigation so that they can report that to us yet.
What has Consumers told you about the event?
Well, we were in constant communication with them, because as soon as the fire started, it was clear that we could have a real serious issue. Usage was up such an incredible amount. The temperature plummeted, and it was, we were in constant communication. They've got to do a look back analysis and I think give everyone a report on what happened so that we learn from it, they learn from it, and they put their plan together, and the MPSC has facts so they can move forward.
You, along with, you were part of the emergency alert service messaging, asking citizens to turn down their thermostats. Some complied. Some ignored the request, and some, on social media anyway, were just downright belligerent about the request. Did we end up getting enough people to help out to make a real difference?
We did. Consumers reported that usage dropped 10 points, that was extremely meaningful in this crisis by declaring a state of emergency early in the week and closing a number of our departments and buildings down across the state. We participated, General Motors, Ford, Chrysler, all of them closed down in order to make sure that need was met and the system was not overtaxed. And we got through the storm, but now we've got to make sure that they, consumers, have a plan, and that we as a state know what our resources, assets are, and have plans when crises hit like this.
So we've all learned a little bit more about the distribution system. You're new on the job. You've probably learned more about the gas distribution system than you knew before. Any lessons we've learned to this point?
Well, we mobilized quickly. I'm grateful that we had such a robust early discussion, getting the facts and moved thoughtfully, but also swiftly. The actions we took, I believe, made sure that we were better off as a result of it because we were prepared. We were ready to go into action as crises popped up across the state, and we helped a lot of people. And had we not acted so swiftly, we might not have had this kind of result. And so making quick decisions and opening up lines of communication and listening to the experts was something important. But certainly, as a result of this, I've asked the MPSC to do their analysis and make recommendations so that we are able to ensure the safety of our citizenry going forward.
Gretchen Whitmer is the governor of Michigan. Thanks for taking the time.
Thank you. Stay warm. It's going to get warm. Be careful on the roads.
Okay, thanks. Let's now turn to an energy grid expert. Johanna Matthew is an assistant professor at the University of Michigan. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
She joins us by Skype. The governor wants to look into energy supplies and emergency preparedness. If you were asked to review what happened this week, what would you be investigating first?
Well, first, I think we want to find out what exactly happened and then understand if the cost and benefits of fixing that or upgrading the system so that it would never happen again are worth it, or instead coming up with good strategies to recover from similar events in the future, because it all comes down to if we value reliability more or if we're going to lay out a lot of money.
Yeah, the security of making sure that it's uninterrupted would seem to be pretty important to the state. And I would think if one compressor at a facility was that important, you'd have some redundancies, a backup plan. How typical is it to have a failure like this and yet you just have to wait until the equipment is replaced?
I don't think it's too typical for these sorts of failures to happen, but I do know that both gas grids and electric grids have a lot of redundancy and backup plans to plan for exactly these sorts of emergencies. And it seems like most of the things that were done after the fire and explosion did go right, in the sense that we were able to use backup compressors to compress the gas and get it to the consumers. And at some point, there just was a little bit of shortfall. And so we had to ask consumers to respond and reduce their consumption.
Yeah, the one thing I didn't quite understand is that these pipelines are apparently connected between, for instance, DTE and Consumers Energy. Is that something that needs to be strengthened? Because could DTE have done more if they had more connections to consumers?
It seems like the issue here wasn't the pipeline connections, but instead the compressor station. So if there were more connections that could enable the compressors to compress the gas in another system, then probably it would be the case that DTE could help more. My understanding, though, is that the systems are already quite connected and that they were relying on neighbors to help push the gas through.
I guess what's this week's failure say about the natural gas supply infrastructure in Michigan? Is it any weaker than other states?
My understanding is no, that it's not weaker. I mean, I think that these sorts of things can happen anywhere, in particular on these incredibly cold days that, you know, we haven't seen in the past. And that the important thing is that we plan for when these events could happen and what to do to recover. In particular, what I found interesting here is asking consumers to respond by reducing their thermostats really helped the system. And this is something we commonly do in the electric grid. We ask consumers to sign up for programs where they get incentivized to participate by reducing their electricity bill so that when the grid is stressed, they get called upon to reduce their consumption. And this is usually by reducing air conditioner usage in the summer. Maybe we need to do something similar in the national gas system. And I think we haven't done that in the past, but there's mechanisms to achieve that.
You mentioned electric. We were asked to reduce electricity usage also because of the cold this week. In fact, the entire Midwest was under that strain. And I thought back to the Northeast Electric Power Blackout in 2003 and then the gas failure this week and then asking us to, you know, ease up on electric usage this week, it makes you wonder whether the energy grids we rely on are as reliable as we think they are. What's your take?
Well, I think that they are actually incredibly reliable, and the fact that we can keep them working when bad things happen is pretty impressive. I mean, we do see power outages happen from time to time, yet generally we can get the grids back online pretty quickly. What's interesting is those cases that you just mentioned, the Northeast blackout, and then the case this week, were caused by completely different types of issues. And so it's hard to plan for absolutely everything that could happen, but I think the important thing is having a fallback plan so the whole grid, the grid or the natural gas system doesn't sort of collapse. One thing we're doing to make that operation more smooth, so hopefully this happens less in the future, is to try to coordinate different types of energy systems together, because traditionally they've been operating independently. But there's an interesting research problems about how you coordinate the operation of the gas grid and the electric grid together, because obviously they affect each other.
So what are you going to be watching now that we've seen this? I mean, is there a lesson to be learned by you and that you can relate to your students?
Yeah. I mean, I think that what we want to learn from this sort of thing, is this something we could have planned for? And if we had planned for it, would it have been more important to try to prevent it from happening in the first place? Or is it the sort of thing that we need to develop strategies to be able to recover quickly and effectively? And I think there's a very different set of costs and benefits associated with those two strategies, basically preventing something from happening versus recovering from it, right? And given that, I think that there could be a lot of interesting things to explore in terms of those costs and benefits.
Johanna Matthew is an assistant professor in the College of Engineering at the University of Michigan. Thanks for taking the time.
Thank you.
Still to come, Florence Noel Bassett was a giant of mid-century modern design and changed the way we view office space.
She would call herself an interior architect, not an interior designer, and certainly not an interior decorator.
After the break, we'll talk about her Michigan roots. Then, in 10 minutes, we visit an artisan of Michigan who builds reproductions of the first pianos. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. A leading designer and architect from Michigan died 1 week ago today. Florence Noel Bassett was known for changing how we understand office space in the U.S. Joining us now to tell us more about Noel Bassett is the director of the Cranbrook Art Museum, Andrew Blauvelt. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
It's been noted that Florence Noel Bassett was a giant of mid-century modern design. Describe how we would recognize mid-century modern.
Well, Michigan, you know, of course, holds a special place in the development of all of that, in part because of Cranbrook, but also because of Detroit at mid-century. So mid-century modernism would be essentially kind of the American version of a kind of Bauhaus or German modernism. So a little bit more color, a little bit more, maybe a little bit more organic curvature to the forms. But this is basically what people associate with sort of the Mad Men era.
Tell me what offices look like before her influences and mid-century moderns kind of takeover of office space.
Yeah, well, offices were dominated by, you know, heavy wood furniture, traditional upholstery fabrics, not really kind of conceived separately from the architectural envelope. And Florence, who studied architecture, so she's one of the women who studied architecture early on in the early days and studied with all the most famous 20th century modern architects, really brought the idea of the architecture to the inside. Like, she would call herself an interior architect, not an interior designer, and certainly not an interior decorator.
Right. I saw that she really resisted that label of decorator. Why was that an important distinction for her?
because it usually has a kind of, well, to a lot of architects, a pejorative connotation that you're there merely to decorate the space as a kind of a complete afterthought. And she really conceived of the idea of a planning of the, this was like, a, you know, in the mid-century, so after World War II, the emergence of the American corporation in many corporate campuses across the country and around the world, for that matter, she wanted to bring those principles of planning and organization to the inside environment. So she was very rigorous about developing, you know, studying the client's needs, the arrangement of the organization, the workflows, how people interacted. So she really brought a lot of rigor to how space should be planned and organized inside, particularly a company.
What were some of her high-profile projects?
She did work for all the major Fortune 500 companies, basically, in mid-century. So IBM, GM, Heinz, the list just goes on and on, because it's basically what you would see like in Mad Men or an episode like that. The organization of that kind of space is really a product of her thinking. I think her magic was that she was able to translate the principles of modern architecture and develop it at a different scale, at the interior scale. So she did a lot of furniture design, although she didn't necessarily consider herself a furniture designer, but she did design furniture, and she created a lot of the pieces that were very simple in form, so traditionally like simple, almost minimal form, but very refined materials and very well-crafted and built. That was kind of her forte. She was able to bring that kind of language into the office space.
We're talking about Florence Noel Bassett with the director of Cranbrook Art Museum, Andrew Blavatt. Tell me about her life in Michigan and at Cranbrook.
Right. So she was born in Saginaw, Michigan. She was orphaned at a pretty young age, at like 12 or 13, and that's how she ends up at Kingswood. So her connections to Cranbrook are twofold. She's a graduate of Kingswood, which was at that time a school for girls here on the Cranbrook campus, in one of the first classes. So she graduates there in 1934. The school opened in 1932. The Cranbrook campus, if you've been there, is known as, it's very, you know, it's an architectural masterpiece. And so she kind of was encouraged to develop her leanings in design and interest in design and architecture there. And she ended up coming to study at Cranbrook Academy of Art, which is the art school here on the Cranbrook campus, in the 1930s. And then later coming back and working with other major designers like Eero Saarinen.
I was going to say, we can't talk about her without talking about the Saarinen family. Tell us a little bit her connections to the family.
So she was essentially not officially adopted, but because of her interest in architecture, she was connected to Eliel Saarinen, who was the president of Cranbrook Academy of Art at the time, and of course a famous 20th century architect. So she was developing her skills, and his, and the Saarinen family is, you know, a very talented family where the son and the daughter, son Eero, the daughter Pipsen, they were both designers, and Eero was, of course, a famous 20th century architect, would go on to become that. But she was also immersed in the scene at Cranbrook at the time in the 1930s. So she would have been, she knew Charles Eames, for example, who was here studying, as well as Harry Bertoia, who was also a student teacher here at the Academy. So she was immersed in this milieu, and that's how she kind of, she ends up studying with, like I said, you know, in Europe and in the United States and working with probably the most famous people. But all of that comes from their time here at Cranbrook.
Just so people know who Eero Saarinen is, give me a couple of examples of his work. I'm from St. Louis, so I'm quite aware of the Gateway Arch there is his, but he's got some other significant buildings that we would all know.
Right. So he designed Dulles Airport in Washington, what was the TWA terminal at JFK Airport, for example. He also designed the GM Tech Center, a project they inherited from his father, Eliel Saarinen, and completely redesigned, which was probably the, you know, the most beautiful, most advanced corporate campus at mid-century.
Yeah, if you've never had a chance to, if you ever get the chance to go see the GM design headquarters, it's really worth the trip.
Yeah, it's quite spectacular.
How well recognized was Florence Noel Bassett by her peers?
Very. She was the connector. She, you know, like I said, she had studied with Walter Gropius, with Mies van der Rohe. So she was able to put into production a lot of their furniture designs. She commissioned Eero Saarinen, of course, to design many pieces for Noel as well. So she had a whole network around the world of architects and designers, and was really, you know, befriended them and created an entire company. And ran it. She married Hans Noel, whose family was originally German and then had Hans Noll come to the United States to create a modern furniture company. She starts working for Hans Noll and is really becomes the head of design. So she's the design genius behind Noll. And he was, of course, the business genius. But he died in a car accident in the 1950s. And she took over the company probably like when she's like 37, 38.
Yeah, and she retired fairly early, too. Do we know why?
She had remarried, and she remarried Harry Bassett in Florida, a banker. And she retired in the sense from Noll, but she still did private commissions and still, you know, performed that role as interior architect on a lot of projects. But she stepped down into a role back when she was really the head of design. And so she did that for like 5 years after the death of Hans Noll. But I think that's also one of the things that we stress today, that she's an important businesswoman. And in terms of developing, you know, a worldwide design empire, basically, and highly unusual for the time period. So quite an achievement.
What kind of imprint did she leave on Cranbrook?
Oh, well, of course, there's a consistent kind of legacy here in relationship with Noll. Over the years, Noll has employed and hired designers from Cranbrook, you know, more recently, because it's known as the Center for Furniture Design with many, many important names. She's kind of a reflection of Cranbrook. I think that's kind of the interesting thing. She did many other, like, innovations as well in the field. But I think what she took from Cranbrook, because Eliel Saarinen created the campus, and the campus is a historic landmark, and it's one of the few completely designed environments in America, where Eliel Saarinen believed in designing everything from the landscape that the building sits on, to the building itself, to the furniture inside the building, to the plates and dishes that would be on the table inside the building. So it worked on many different scales. And she also approached her work from that same way, wanting to bring modern architecture inside and complete a total design environment. So I think she learned that from the Cranbrook experience.
Andrew Blauvelt is the director of Cranbrook Art Museum. We've been talking about the life of architect and designer Florence Noll Bassett, who passed away a week ago today at the age of 101. Thanks for telling us about her life.
You're welcome.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. We've been working on a continuing series which looks at the work of craftspeople who make the things we use. It's called Artisans of Michigan. This time, we go to Ann Arbor. Sometimes your plans get disrupted. Sometimes you take a leap of faith. That's the story of David Sutherland. He was a musician.
After I had finished a PhD in musicology at the University of Michigan and had taught for 4 years, I couldn't get a job. And I decided, well, hey, teaching didn't work out so well.
Now, when he was a teenager, he had visited the shop of one of the better harpsichord makers in the world. His name was John Challis. He worked in Ypsilanti and later Detroit. Sutherland was hooked. He wanted to make them, but his parents persuaded him that going to college made more sense. Since teaching didn't seem to be an option for Sutherland, he decided to apprentice with another major harpsichord maker, Frank Hubbard.
It was a wildly irresponsible decision financially. I mean, I just decided, well, I'm going to do it. So I did it, and we somehow got by, I don't know how, I have never regretted it.
David Sutherland ended up making in his own shop about 100 harpsichord and other keyboard instruments, chiefly Italian harpsichords, which most people didn't seem interested in.
We all thought at that time, well, so Italian instruments are just these little dinky things. They have very few notes and they only have one keyboard and so forth. And it took me a while to realize how how wonderful the style was.
So that's how he made his living for a long time, until his interests changed. He kept his last harpsichord, and it's in his home now.
I think that I made this about 2010.
So just a matter of losing interest in this particular instrument.
I just got really interested in the pianos. The fact of the matter is that pianos are a lot closer to harpsichords than we realize.
The difference is in the mechanism. There was an Italian musician working for the aristocratic Medici family of Florence. Bartolomeo Cristofori came up with a way to strike the strings of a keyboard instrument that allowed dynamic variation, soft and loud, which is what pianoforte means. So we know who invented the piano.
We don't know who he apprenticed with or who he worked with, but he was established as a keyboard instrument maker in Padua, which is the university town of Venice. Sometime in the late 17th century, this is the late 1600s we're talking about, he got the idea of equipping these instruments with a much more precise and profound capacity of dynamic variation, and in particular of being able to change from note to note so that you could play loudly and then softly, and then loudly and then softly, which you can't do on an instrument like this.
And that's what Sutherland makes now, replicas, copies of Cristofori's pianos. He's working on his sixth piano now, as he showed me in his shop.
This piano is not complete,
no, it sure
but
isn't.
It looks very much like the shape and form of the harpsichord you were just showing.
Yeah, absolutely. I remember when I made my first piano and took it around showing it, you know, at various places. People would say to me, but it looks like a harpsichord. And it really irritated me. I mean, I tried to be polite, and I'd say, well, it's not a harpsichord. It's very different. You know, and I would say, these dumb it's not a harpsichord. It's up here. But yes, it looks exactly like, and it was named by the same name. It was an improved string keyboard instrument.
Sutherland's first piano actually got some interesting attention. He'd made one for the St. Paul Schubert Club in Minnesota. That was a couple of years before the Smithsonian's American History Museum held a special exhibit on the 300th anniversary of the piano. The Smithsonian actually got one of the three remaining Cristofori pianos for the exhibit from the Italians. It was a hugely popular exhibit, and the folks at the Smithsonian wanted to extend its time.
So they got in touch with the Italian government, and the Italians said, no dice. We want it back. So then they thought, what are we going to do? So they finally wound up by writing to the Schubert Club in Minneapolis, who had commissioned this, and saying, can we borrow this for the continuation of the piano show?
So they borrowed your piano from the St. Paul Schubert Club.
The track on here that I'm suggesting would be good for this show gives a very interesting idea, I think a good idea, of what the piano was especially favored for at the beginning, which was its ability to play softly.
This is David Sutherland's piano, his first, a replica of a 1726 Cristofori piano. It's being played by Elaine Fornero, a piece by Giovanni Benedetto Plotti.
How long have you been making harpsichords and pianos?
Well, my first dated instrument was 1974. And then I retired about 3 years ago.
You didn't retire. You've got work right here on the bench.
I intended to, but I'm not at the top of my game anymore, and it's really hard to do this. I can only work about 4 or 5 hours during the day, and I make mistakes, and I just feel as if it's really hard to to get myself together to do this because it's a very challenging instrument. It's a very challenging instrument.
He hopes to have this piano finished by sometime this summer.
I would like to make one more after this one, another version, another repetition of this pattern. I would really like to. And I would love it if the School of Music would buy it.
That is the University of Michigan School of Music. He thinks there's a pianist there who would appreciate playing a Cristofori piano in the same way he's appreciated making it. That's David Sutherland, maker of harpsichords and now pianos, our latest Artisan of Michigan.
Support for arts and culture coverage comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs.
Coming up, many in higher education are criticizing the new proposed changes to Title IX.
Universities develop student disciplinary processes that mimic what would happen in a legal setting.
That's after the break. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Higher education has responded to U.S. Secretary of Education Betsy DeVos's proposed changes to Title IX rules. Secretary DeVos wants to implement a, quote, workable, effective, and fair system that she says would do more for survivors of sexual assault and be more fair to those who are accused of sexual assault. The American Council on Education, which is the major voice in Washington for higher ed, submitted a 33-page response to the proposed changes. Joining us now is Terry Hartle. He's Senior Vice President of Government and Public Affairs for the organization. Welcome to Stateside.
Thank you very much. I'm pleased to be here.
How did this proposed change to Title IX come about?
Well, Title IX was actually enacted in 1972, and the government has not issued any regulations around it since that time. In 2011, the Obama administration, through administrative action, imposed a set of requirements that colleges and universities had to follow to address sexual harassment, sexual misconduct, and sexual assault when it was occurred on campus. There was never any sort of public discussion about what the administration imposed. They just said, this is what you have to do. Now, the Trump administration entered office and said, we don't think they should have put those requirements in place in that fashion. These are legally binding. The public, all parts of the public, the survivors, the accused, the institutions, need the opportunity to comment on regulations so that we can develop the most effective ways to proceed. So the Trump administration withdrew the Obama-era guidance and has embarked on a process to put formal regulations in place. This is the first step in that process.
Your group calls parts of these proposed Title IX changes problematic. What are your chief concerns about it?
Biggest concern with the draft regulations is that they would ask colleges and universities to become courts. They want colleges and universities to develop student disciplinary processes that mimic what would happen in a legal setting. These are not courtrooms that we run. These are student disciplinary actions. So we're concerned that the legalization of this process imposes requirements on us that we are completely incapable of delivering on.
I was reading a report from the Chronicle of Higher Education, and in it notes you call for the flexibility to treat different cases differently. Why is that important?
Well, sexual assault cases are among the most difficult, challenging issues that come before colleges for student disciplinary action. In most cases, there are conflicting stories about what happened, no witnesses, no evidence, substance abuse, and often a considerable time lag between the incident and its actual reporting to colleges and universities. If all sexual assault cases were identical, it would be easy to develop a single process that would work equally well for all of them. Unfortunately, there's an enormous range of variation in the way these cases present themselves, some of which are virtually impossible to sort out, some of which are more straightforward. So being able to tailor our disciplinary processes to the facts as they present themselves in a way that supports the survivor and is fair to both parties is something that's very important.
The letter indicates the Department of Ed should work with colleges to prevent sexual abuse and harassment, not work against them, as some institutions feel the Obama administration was doing. But in this state, we've been watching the horror story of how Michigan State University allowed a serial predator to go on to molest girls and women for a couple of decades. Why shouldn't the Department of Ed investigate allegations of mishandling sexual misconduct cases?
Oh, there's no question that the Department of Education should and will investigate mishandling of sexual assault cases by colleges and universities. What happened at Michigan State is an absolute tragedy. It was a combination, I think, of human errors and an unwillingness to act. The Department of Ed has already begun an investigation, and there will be a considerable day of reckoning for Michigan State with the federal government in the months ahead.
So this was a particularly egregious case, but why wouldn't you do that in any situation where there was an accusation of mishandling?
Well, they do it in any individual can file a complaint with the Department of Education over a potential violation of Title IX. The Department of Education conducts a preliminary investigation before deciding whether or not to open a full investigation. At the end of the day, what colleges and universities want is the best possible administrative framework to support the survivor, to be fair to both parties, and to clearly understand the federal government's expectations on the institution. The vast majority of colleges are desperately anxious to do the right thing. The government can help with an appropriate and clear, comprehensible administrative framework, or they can complicate that if the requirements are complex, confusing, and vague.
In the view of your organization, what is the proper balance for these colleges and universities you represent?
I think the key issue for us is clarity of expectations and a regulatory regime that helps us support the survivor, be fair to both parties, and address these cases in a timely way. The vast majority of colleges and universities desperately want to do the right thing. The cases are inherently hard because of the way they present themselves. Substance abuse often involves no witnesses, no evidence, different stories about what happened. Figuring out what actually happened can be enormously difficult. We need as much clarity of expectations as we can get, but we also need the government to clearly recognize when colleges have unambiguously acted in good faith to try and resolve these cases. Dealing with sexual assault cases is something that colleges and universities must do. There is no dispute about our obligation to address these when they present themselves. The question is, how can we do it most effectively, and what federal policies will make that happen?
Terry Hartle is Senior Vice President of Government and Public Affairs of the American Council on Education, a group which lobbies Washington on behalf of higher education institutions. Thanks for taking the time to explain your positions on this.
Delighted to be with you. Thanks for having me.
An audit of the Michigan Strategic Fund, sometimes ridiculed as Michigan's corporate welfare program, was critical about how well the agency did in tracking whether it got a return on investments, whether grants to companies actually resulted in the jobs promised, and so on. Joining us to discuss those findings are our Friday political commentators. Vicki Barnett is a former mayor of Farmington Hills and a former Democratic state legislator. Ken Sikkema, senior policy fellow at Public Sector Consultants and a former Republican legislative leader. Vicki, what do you think of these findings of the audit of the Michigan Strategic Fund?
I'm not surprised. We've had this problem ongoing for years, that the dollars spent are not tracked, the number of jobs created are not tracked, the salary of the jobs are not tracked, and yet the money goes out the door. And this is really serious, because a lot of this money is, and this is not the only program that the Michigan Strategic Fund operates, and it happens across the board in many of the programs that they operate. And some of these include incentives that not just dollars and cash on the barrel, but incentives that affect the school aid fund and sales tax revenue, and that affects the school aid fund and revenue sharing for local communities. So this is a serious problem, ongoing. We've tried to correct it with legislation, which requires these kinds of tracking operations, and it's still not being done.
Ken, the Michigan Strategic Fund is considered by some to be innovative, a real way to lure businesses to the state and help existing businesses expand. But former House Fiscal Agency Director Mitch Bean once told me it's basically a political slush fund for whoever is governor at the time. What's your take on it?
Well, these special tax breaks and grants to select companies to create jobs have always been controversial. I mean, you know, you have, I guess, a lot of Republicans sort of on the right wing of the party say you shouldn't have them at all because they are just corporate welfare or crony capitalism. The fact of the matter is most legislators and governors look upon it as a necessary arrow in the quiver, because all states have them and you're competing for job creation. But this Auditor General report, as Vicki pointed out, is pretty serious. It basically says you have to improve your efforts to evaluate the economic impact of these programs. And the fact that it had to come out with that kind of report is just going to add to the controversy over whether or not you should have these programs at all. But like I pointed out, basically the attitude has been all the states have them, we got to have them, but boy, you better be able to prove their effectiveness, I think, and over time.
Yeah, you know, I watched the same thing happen in Illinois when I worked there, gosh, 2 decades ago, and it was just growing by leaps and bounds. Every state was starting to really get progressive with this. But, you know, coincidentally this week, the huge Taiwanese electronics company Foxconn told Wisconsin that it's not going to be building TVs there. It's not going to be hiring blue-collar workers, but instead that Wisconsin facility will basically now be a research and development center. And that's after the state invested billions of dollars into that project and its promises. Michigan was ready to offer Foxconn a $3.7 billion package. Vicki, what should state officials be thinking regarding those big dollars to entice these projects?
They should be rethinking them totally. Originally, some of these incentives were established to lure businesses to economically depressed areas of the state. And there were a list of cities that needed investment that already had the necessary infrastructure to serve the businesses should they go in and build the company. Those kinds of tax incentives made a lot of sense, because it reused brownfields, it helped clean up areas, and it brought needed jobs to areas that needed the economic boost. That was a smart way to use state dollars to incentivize job creation and development. The kind of things we're seeing now are exactly the kind of things that Governor Snyder said he didn't want to do when he was first elected and revamped the entire tax structure in 2011 and said, okay, we're going to lower taxes for all businesses to 6% and we're done. That's all you get. And then they eliminated personal property tax and sweetened the pot a little more. And still we ended up with the governor calling for incentives to lure Amazon and to lure Foxconn to Michigan. So this is a major problem, and I think we're rightly starting to investigate whether these things make sense or not.
You know, you mentioned Amazon HQ2 and Foxconn. Ken, these offers to businesses are getting bigger all the time, but there are some major money going out on projects like, well, the Illich has got substantial sums or incentives for the Little Caesars Arena in Detroit. Dan Gilbert's gotten some sweetheart deals from the state and city. Where should we be drawing the line on this stuff?
Well, you know, Foxconn might have pulled a fast one here on Wisconsin. I mean, who really knows? And the question is, I think, for these states, and this includes Michigan, is what kind of clawback provisions do you put into these deals where if the company fails to deliver, you know, they've got to pay the state back or the local community back. I'm sort of in the camp, though, that you can't just unilaterally disarm, meaning eliminate all of these. I think you've got to compete, and you just got to be extremely careful, I guess, about how you draw up these deals and ensure that economic promises that are made, and particularly in terms of job creation, they actually deliver on. And if they don't, they've got to pay the state or the community back. I think that's about the only way you can sort of handle these.
We're going to break format here a little bit because, Ken, you were in the news this week. I want to talk about that a little bit. You're one of the members of a bipartisan group calling for a phased-in gas tax for fixing the damn roads. What's that all about? What are you recommending?
Well, the I guess the larger sort of issue in terms of this group of Bob Emerson, John Cherry, Paul Hillegons, and myself started about a year ago. We were just kind of distressed with the intense polarization in politics today and wanted to show that even in a partisan environment, you can reach consensus on things. And we started talking last June about the road issue, and we came to the conclusion that we didn't have any interest in kind of offering a partial solution. And basing our recommendation on the 21st Century Infrastructure Commission that identified a $2.6 billion annual need to really fix Michigan roads, if you were going to use the gas tax, it's a 47-cent increase. Now, we actually propose you phase it in over 9 years because kind of dumping all that kind of money is just probably the system doesn't have the capacity to prudently spend it, on top of the fact that if you phase it in, it's just more palatable to motorists and consumers. But that's the recommendation we make. It's still that we still like the gas tax because it's a user fee. It's paid in relatively modest amounts on a regular basis. You can phase it in over a period of years, but that's what it will take to fix Michigan roads.
I want to ask you about that because a lot of people see this as a regressive tax because poor people who have less efficient vehicles, who might have to drive farther for work, are going to get hit by this tax harder than other people.
Well, the current situation is far more regressive because the average Michigan motorist, whether you're poor, middle class, or rich, pays over $600 a year in vehicle costs because of poor roads. And that's extremely regressive because that's also on low-income people. And that's accelerated depreciation on vehicles, more wear and tear on tires, repair costs. The attractive feature of the gas tax continues to be that the more you use the roads, the more you pay. So in that sense, it's not regressive. It's a user pay sort of principle. But I would point out the current situation of over $600 a year for poor people paying on vehicle maintenance because of crappy roads in Michigan is more regressive.
That is Ken Sikkema. He's senior policy fellow at Public Sector Consultants and a former Republican majority leader of the state Senate. We also heard from Vicki Barnett, former mayor of Farmington Hills and a former Democratic legislator. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Lester.
Well, we hate to do it, but we have to say goodbye to Lindsay Scullin. She's been at Michigan Radio for more than 4 years, working on online news, working with the marketing department, and then with us on Stateside, where she's been our director. Lindsay, we're going to miss you tons. Good luck on your new adventures. Today's Stateside was directed by Mercedes Mejia and engineered by Rusty Brock, who's been sipping some brown liquid and a little evasive about what it might be.
Our executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors today are Mike Blank, April Van Buren, Joy Horan, and, of course, Lindsay Scullin. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Lester Graham. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend.